Hello, I'm Joseph Kassa, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up a fascinating case of organizational crisis. It's all happening inside a major professional society, the International Council on Systems Engineering, or INTICOS.
That's right. And we have this incredible pile of internal documentation.
It's a mountain of it. And it lays out this incredibly tense conflict that really pits the idea of due process against, you know, organizational culture.
It's got everything. We're talking about a disciplinary ban that had never really been seen before, allegations of a, and this is a quote, a kangaroo court, and even a multi-million dollar lawsuit threat hanging over the whole thing.
So our mission for this deep dive is to follow the paper trail. We're going to track how this one grievance, which started with a contributor named Joe Kasser being banned from presenting, just completely spiraled.
It really did. It escalated into this huge challenge to the organization's governance. This whole thing centers on their formal grievance procedure, policy ADM 200, and what happens when an organization just decides to ignore its own rules.
Exactly. What does this whole mess reveal about who gets to decide what's acceptable or collegial in a field that's supposed to be about critical thinking? Let's get into it.
Okay, so to really get this, you have to understand the vibe Inculity tries to create at its events, its symposia.
Right.
They aim for an open and collegial dialogue. That word, collegial, is key. The documents stress they want a cordial and non-confrontational atmosphere.
But systems engineering, I mean, the whole point of the field is critical analysis, right? You have to challenge things, you have to benchmark them. That feels like it could easily become confrontational.
It can, and that's exactly the problem. Kasser's work, it often involved benchmarking systems engineering education programs.
Oh, okay.
Think about who is at these conferences. A lot of them are academics, or they're industry people whose companies are tied to these exact programs.
So when he titles the panel, "Are Postgraduate Courses in Systems Engineering Teaching the Right Things?" You're not just asking a technical question. You are poking some very powerful people and institutions directly. You're hitting political nerves. So a robust discussion pretty quickly turns into what feels like a personal attack. And this wasn't the first time he'd raised red flags, was it?
Not at all. The first official note we have is from back in 2012. Curry Fosna, who was the AD for technical events, he flagged Kasser's Q&A style after a presentation.
And told him what?
He told him it was, quote, not in keeping with this intention of collegiality. And he gave him a warning about it.
Okay, but this warning becomes a huge point of contention later. Kasser's description of it is, well, it's pretty dismissive.
It is. He called it a brief and hurried discussion with Terje in a hallway or smoking area.
That hardly sounds like a formal disciplinary action. It sounds like a chat.
Exactly. It shows how informal everything was. So when the next big incident happens in 2014, the board gets multiple negative reactions about his Q&A session.
And their worst fears are confirmed.
Right. And when Foskin confronts him about it later, Kasser's reaction is described as non-conciliatory. He didn't back down.
So that brings us to the big decision. They have this formal policy, ADM 200, made for exactly this kind of problem. But they don't use it. Why not?
Well, the board talked about it, but they decided filing a formal grievance would have lose-lose consequences. They were probably terrified of the public fight, the legal risks of a formal investigation.
They wanted it handled, but quietly.
Discreetly.
Yeah.
So they just skipped the formal process completely.
And that move right there, that's a huge governance problem. They set up an informal committee.
Including Cecilia Haskins, Dave Long, and Bill Miller. And their job was to act discreetly. It was basically a secret court.
Passing judgment in the shadows.
And the judgment was. It was severe. In December 2014, they banned Kasser from presenting in any capacity at the next two symposia.
Wow, 2 full years.
2 years. And to really twist the knife for an academic, they pulled his papers for the 2015 event right out of the peer review process.
That is absolutely career damaging. That is so much more than just a warning.
Oh, yeah. And the source material makes a point of this. This was only the third formal complaint in INCOISI's history to lead to a sanction.
So they threw the book at him.
They threw the book at him without actually opening their own rule book first.
Okay, so obviously Kasser isn't going to just take that. His response focuses entirely on the process, not on his own behavior.
Exactly. His reply in December 2014 is a masterclass in procedural warfare. He argues the ban is invalid because the way they did it violated ADM 200 from top to bottom.
And what were the specific violations he pointed to?
Okay, so first, anonymity. The policy requires transparency. He was being punished based on anonymous complaints. He was never even told what inappropriate statement he supposedly made.
How can you defend yourself against that?
You can't. That was his point. Second, there was no investigation. None. They just acted on the negative reactions they heard about. It was all hearsay.
So he's found guilty, banned, his work is censored, and it's all based on secret complaints with no evidence.
Precisely. And he even used that 2012 incident against them.
Mm.
He said, you know, that vague hallway chat, that's not a formal warning. If you want to warn someone formally, it has to be in writing. There has to be a record.
It's interesting because the documents show he knew the 2014 panel would be controversial. He actually tried to get ahead of it.
He did. He said he and his co-author did risk management. They showed their slides beforehand to people from the very institutions they were critiquing, like Stevens Institute.
And what was the reaction?
He says it was always well-received and non-confrontational. He even points out that someone, Elliot Axelbrand, publicly congratulated him right there at the event for giving the least controversial presentation in years.
And that was before the Q&A ended.
Right. So the organization just ignored all of that and focused only on the negative chatter they heard afterwards.
So Kasser immediately demands all the notes, the full list of who was on the secret committee, any proof of an investigation.
And when they don't provide it, he files a formal grievance in January 2015. He's not just appealing his ban anymore. Now he's accusing the officers of misconduct.
So he forces them to use ADM 200, the very policy they tried to avoid. The case goes to Alan Harding, the president-elect.
Right. And Harding's job is to find a solution at the lowest possible level. His determination in February 2015 is, it's really something. He tries to split the difference.
How so?
He acknowledges Kasser has a history of a confrontational and caustic manner. But he also calls out the organization's failure. He says the informal committee acted, and this is the key phrase, outside their written authority.
And that's the legal smoking gun, isn't it? It means they had no power to issue the ban at all.
None. So Harding's compromise is to undo the damage. The two-year ban is canceled in full. He says it was too harsh, badly timed.
And the papers.
They're reinstated for peer review. One of them actually gets accepted into the program.
Okay, so the ban is gone. The paper is back in. It sounds like a win. Why did Kasser reject this?
Because Harding tried to have it both ways. To punish the officers, he issued a letter of reprimand to the individuals on that informal committee.
And that wasn't enough for Kasser.
Not even close. He saw it as the organization upholding the guilty verdict against him, but without any due process, while the officers got a slap on the wrist that would just be hidden away in a file.
That's where his famous write-only memory line comes from.
That's the one. He said a letter on file is just a way for the organization to say they did something, but it's never seen, it's not actionable, and it doesn't hold anyone truly accountable. So he rejected the whole deal.
And then he really escalates things. He goes public with conflict of interest allegations against the very people who judged him.
He does. He points out that Bill Miller, who was on that secret committee, was an industry professor at Stevens Institute.
The same Stevens Institute that Kasser's presentation was seen as targeting?
The very same. He also pointed out that another committee member, Cecilia Haskins, was married to Terje Fosnes, the official who issued the original warnings.
This isn't just about procedure anymore. He's questioning their integrity, their moral authority to judge him at all.
Which leads him to his ultimate weapon, the lawsuit.
The threat of a $1 million personal injury lawsuit for libel and slander.
And it was a clever two-pronged threat. On one hand, he was warning NQC in general, saying, look, your kangaroo court process is going to get you sued by someone someday.
But he also made it very personal.
Oh, absolutely. It was his plan D. He made it crystal clear that if his demands weren't met and his plan A was the immediate resignation of all five officers, he would file that $1 million suit.
His argument being that a professional body publicly declaring you're unfit to present is, by definition, defamation. It damages your reputation and career.
It's a huge liability for any professional society. It completely forced their hand. After he rejected Harding's compromise, the case had to be escalated. In April 2015, it goes to the full grievance committee.
And the official reason given was pretty blunt.
It was.
Yeah.
Too many people have acted without the appropriate authority.
But even with the formal committee involved, the delays just kept coming, and Kasser stayed on them.
He was like a hawk. He documented every time they missed the 30-day status report deadline required by their own policy. By summer, he's threatening to call a special meeting of the entire membership to vote the officers out.
He's using every tool in the procedural toolkit.
Every single one. And finally, in December 2015, almost a year after the ban, the final ruling comes down.
So what did the full grievance committee decide?
So the board of directors approved their conclusions. First, they agreed that Alan Harding's initial actions, canceling the ban, reinstating the papers, were correct and enough. The original mistake was fixed. Case closed on that part.
So his victory on the ban was made official, but what about accountability for the officers who started this whole mess?
And that is the absolute core of the final decision. This is where you see what Incasser really valued. The committee stated that everyone involved, Casser and all the officers, were members in good standing.
In good standing, okay.
And then, the big one. The grievance committee declined to issue any letters of reprimand. They completely reversed Harding's earlier decision.
Wait, what? So the committee that acted outside their written authority?
Faced zero consequence.
They were just fully absolved.
Yes. The organization fixed the outcome. They got rid of the ban, but they refused to punish the broken process. The message was clear. Protecting their own leadership from public embarrassment was more important than upholding their own rules.
So, after a year of fighting for transparency and accountability, what was Casser's final word?
In January 2016, he sent a short, terse response to the confidential conclusion. He just said he found the resolution unacceptable.
Which makes total sense. They didn't really change anything fundamentally. So this whole saga, what does it teach us? The policy, ADM 200, it was tested, it was ignored, and then it was used to fix a mistake, but it failed to hold the rule breakers accountable.
The real lesson here is about the clash between an organization's stated policies and its actual culture. Incosys, our culture, tries this idea of a cordial atmosphere so much that its leaders were willing to break their own rules to enforce it.
And the policy worked to protect the member, but not to protect itself.
Exactly. It revealed this deep systemic fear of holding leadership accountable in a public way.
Which leaves us with a final question for you, the listener. When an informal group acts with the best of motives, but crucially, outside their written authority, is the mess that follows just a necessary evil? A kind of crucible that forges better, clearer policies in the long run.
Or is the opposite true? When you sacrifice clear due process to protect a subjective internal culture, a culture of collegial dialogue, does that lack of transparency become the single greatest threat to the legitimacy and health of the entire organization?
Something to think about until our next deep dive.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, and you're an Incosy member, why don't you contact Incosy? Send them an email. Ask them a question. Why did the investigation focus on the actions and totally ignore the transitions of the policies and code of ethics? Thank you for listening.